Talk given Friday, 12th September, 1980. Our concern, fundamentally, is with understanding the heart of religion with a view to living the religious life in the true sense of the word. It is the living of the religious life which matters, and not just making an intellectual study of doctrines and dogmas and so forth, which on the whole, the human race being what it is, tend to divide people from each other rather than unite them and make them realize that they, each and every single person, is an integral part and parcel of one whole humanity. Also, the religious life must not be understood as something separate from what we call the secular life. We are essentially religious beings, and only secondarily are we political, economic, and social animals. And if our religiousness does not get a chance to come to fruition in our own life, our political, economic, social, and every other aspect of our life will suffer the consequences. For the very simple reason that the word religion itself means, considering its Latin derivation, to bind back or to gather together. To bind back to what? The source from which we come. And what do we imagine or think is or perceive is the source from which we come? I like to use the word transcendence because it is much less loaded than the usual words which have come into use through the different religions. The words like God or Allah, Ahura Mazda, Brahman, Atma, we do use those words, but we must understand them in the terms of transcendence, which is itself the one total reality, whatsoever that may be. Transcendence is something we cannot know in the ordinary way with our brains, but it is something which can enter into our lives if we so live our daily life that the dormant faculty, the dormant sense of transcendence within us begins to come to life and begins to be awake and operate in our everyday life. This is very important. If that sense of transcendence once awakes, then it is not difficult, or shall I say, not too difficult, to relate our daily life, successful, unsuccessful, sorrowful, pleasurable, whatever it may be, to that root source, transcendence itself, and thereby enable ourselves to be true vehicles. I like to put it this way, that we become the real holy grail for the creative power of transcendence to flow into us and out of us in everything that we do. And thereby the individual not only comes to fulfillment himself and thereby realizes in the supreme degree the meaning of his being a human being. The word human, from its derivation, means a blissful creator. That's its fundamental meaning. Are we blissful creators as we are? Not quite yet anyway, shall we put it rather euphemistically. You see? So that is the sort of general outlook which animates our attempts here. And I can only say our attempts, because transcendence is transcendence. It is, in a sense, quite beyond us. It is unknowable. It is unknowable intellectually, but it can be realized, made real, in terms of actual experiencing transcendence through our own purification. Transcendence is embodied in us. It is actually embodied throughout the whole cosmos. What obstructs this embodied transcendence from being, from our being, what prevents our being at one, united to transcendence as we are at present? The simple fact that there are so many defects in us as ordinary existential beings. We have a body, we have a mind, as we call it. I prefer to say we are a body and psyche combination. We are psychophysical human beings, as we are. And we are growing, we are developing, evolving. And it is in the course of this evolution, growth necessarily must take place. The growth of what? The body has more or less come to fulfillment through the ordinary biological evolutionary process. But what of the mind? What of the psyche? I use the word psyche particularly simply because mind and psyche really are very different things altogether. I have put this out in some considerable detail in that book, The Heart of Religion, but we'll just touch upon the essential point involved. Mind is an archetypal expression on the cosmic scale of the primordial creative energy which releases the entire universe into being. That is what mind is. It releases cosmos out of the primordial quiescence, which is the real meaning of the word chaos. Chaos, its secondary meaning is disorder. But insofar as that creative energy releases cosmos out of this state of quiescent energy, then you have the true meaning of the word mind. Mind is the archetypal expression of that creative energy. There are several other archetypal expressions, but we can't deal with all of them now anyway, or even some of them. There are so many of them. Now, that is mind, and as such, it is universal. It is at the cosmical level. It has no characteristics which we can name. Apart from seeing intellectually that it is that aspect of creative energy, primordial creative energy, which is the source of the universe, apart from that, it is practically impossible to ascribe any further characteristics to it. One may say this much, that it functions in infinity, in eternity, and, of course, is associated with immortality. That is pure mind, and that also is pure consciousness. These three, the primordial creative energy, pure consciousness, and bliss, they are an identity. The brain will, of course, separate them, because the brain cannot function without analyzing, without splitting into different portions as such. That is our brain activity. And that is why our brain and knowledge, all the knowledge that the brain acquires can be considerably obstructive to living the truly religious life in the deep sense of the word, however that may be. Now this creative energy, mind, interacting with the one universal corporeality which produces our body as such, gives rise to what I like to call psyche, specifically psyche as different from mind. Because the psyche and all our ordinary mental processes of thought and feeling and so forth are psychical processes. They are not truly mental processes. The psyche is rooted in the brain and the nervous system, and it is also rooted in the activity of the ductless glands. This is what makes for all the difference in the psyche of any one person from every other person in the world. Now, medical science knows that the evolution of the particular individual is of such a nature that his constitution, his psychophysical constitution, is absolutely unique. There never was anyone like him before. There is no one like him at the moment, and there never will be another one like him in the future. Each individual is absolutely unique because the male and the female gamut, the generative cells which unite, are derived from the parents of the mother and the father by a reorganization of the genetic material. And such is the exuberant creativity of all this primordial energy and genetic material and so forth, that every single combination like that and differentiation produces a totally different individual. You can't relate him to any other individual, past or in the future. It is one of the physical evidences against the idea of reincarnation. Definite biological evidence that is not the case, that reincarnation is not the case. Well, now, the psyche then is rooted in our brain and nervous system and in the activity of the ductless glands, which produce all the different qualities and intellectual and emotional activities of our everyday life. Now it is this psyche which can grow. There is no such thing as growth for the mind, development or evolution of the mind. That is at a totally different level. It is beyond our ken, so to say. The psyche, if the functioning of the physical biological functioning goes wrong, or if circumstances, upbringing, education, food, activity, the influence of our surroundings and so forth is not of the right sort, then the psyche becomes ill. Study your myth of Eros and Psyche. It's most wonderfully illuminating. Psyche is a mortal woman, remarkably beautiful, and that means possessed of extraordinary potentiality, the potentiality to develop into the perfect thing, and that means also perfect humanity as such. Eros, of course, is the immortal god. Now, people began to the beauty of Psyche detracted people from the worship of Aphrodite. and Aphrodite's son was Eros. Eros was also the creator of Aphrodite. That's a very curious thing about the mythologies of the world. You find them saying contrary things. In the Rig Veda, for instance, you find it stated Daksha is the son of the daughter of Aditi, and Aditi was the daughter of Daksha. Now you can't have it both ways, as far as we see things. But there are deep meanings to that sort of statement. So Aphrodite became jealous of Psyche and told Eros to touch her with his arrow so that she'd fall in love with a mortal, and an ugly mortal preferably. But Eros, seeing her, fell in love with her. And it became conditional upon Psyche that she was not to inquire what Eros was like. Now that's a very interesting point. I'll leave it to you to sort of think it out. She was not to look upon him, but Psyche's two sisters, the ugly sisters of the story, became so jealous of Psyche that they told her, oh, he's a horrible monster, you better find out one day. And Psyche ultimately gave way and tried to look upon Eros. Now, to look upon Eros introduced the element of concupiscence in the story. Also, the wrong sort of search for that which is transcendent, that which is of divine origin. You can't demand the divine for yourself. You have to just let it take you up into itself. You can't demand it. You're not permitted to do that. You can aspire to it, but aspire to it not in the possessive manner. That's the whole point. But in terms of giving yourself wholly to the divine. Psyche, unfortunately, let her curiosity get the better of her, and she lit a lamp and looked upon him, and she beheld a divine being for a moment. Unfortunately for her, a drop of hot oil fell upon Eros. Eros awoke and disappeared altogether, never came again. And Psyche spent many years of misery, dreadful suffering and misery. But through her purification, this is the important point, through her purification, ultimately she met Eros again, and their nuptials were celebrated on Mount Olympus with all the gods attending. But no mortal can wed a god. So they conferred immortality upon Psyche in order that she may it may be perfectly correct for her to be Mrs. Eros. Now that whole story is remarkably instructive if one goes into it. This purification of the psyche, complete and utter purification, which enables immortal love to function through this psyche itself, our own psyche, which now being purified is completely united with pure mind, this archetypal cosmical energy which releases cosmos out of chaos. So that is essentially a religious task. It takes us back to our transcendent source. Remember, the brain will never know it. It happens if you allow it to happen, if you live purely. That's the whole secret of it. One has to live the pure life, and no mistake about that, you see. And by living the pure life, the psyche does become utterly purified, and the mind, as the theistical religions would put it, the mind of God begins to function through you freely, and then you have true insight, which in the Indian texts is called buddhi, which Plato called nous. The Greeks called it nous, and the word nous and the word buddhi do not mean just intuition. Intuition is a very inadequate word. It's not altogether wrong, but it is very inadequate. Buddhi or nous is unerring insight. You see truth then. And how is it that you see truth then? Through the purification of the psyche, and therefore the freer activity of pure mind as such, you are at one with whatsoever perception takes place. And all our perceptions take place through the sense avenues, as well as what we used to call, before the purification of the psyche, our ordinary thinking process. Do you get the point? You see? Therefore, the purification of the psyche is of fundamental importance. It has to happen by itself. And happening by itself, our effort consists in observing carefully exactly everything that happens, all external sources of sensation and so forth, as well as our internal reactions to whatsoever comes to us through our senses. Through that sort of perfect observation, all the conditioning of our brains and so on ceases to obstruct true vision. And then in true vision you are that which you perceive. This is an extraordinary thing altogether. As they put it in the Hindu and Buddhist scriptures, you become that which you perceive. And of course people interpret it this way. If I look at that house with a purified psyche and pure mind functioning, I become that house. No, you don't. It is in mind and consciousness that you are at one with the houseness of that house. When you look at a rose, you are at one with the roseness of the rose, the cloudness of the cloud, and so forth, which is a very, very extraordinary experience to have altogether. But don't seek experience. If you go for it seeking wonderful experiences, you will defeat everything, because it is then your personal greed for some wonderful experience which has made you go along this path, and that is quite the wrong way. It is a self-defeating way. So just observe, perceive, and realize. Now this means, of course, this lies at the very heart of the living of the religious life, this constant observation. Then you'll find that your conduct in everyday life, in action, in speech, and in thought, is right conduct, perfect conduct. Now, one of the, I think I've given rather a long introduction on this matter. Most of you know it, so you must forgive the repetition of all that. But some of these fundamental things can bear repetition. And when one's conduct is perfect, becomes pure, the senses, the sense functions which previously were sources of distraction, of detraction away from transcendence, we become the slaves of our pleasure drives and all the rest of it. Those very senses now become the cords of communion. Because if one lives religiously, thus with pure observation, and realizes the state of selflessness, then the sense of sight enables, or the sense of hearing, or the sense of touch, they all enable you to be in perfect communion with that which is conveyed through that particular sense. It's an extraordinary experience altogether. The great mystics have written a great deal about it. The great poets of the world have all written a great deal about it. And of course it comes in the scriptures of the world too, in various forms. Now, in connection with conduct, behavior, as we call it, look at the world today. How does it behave? Fearfully, destructively, violently. There is so little in the world's behavior en masse which is something truly human. Man lives inhumanly today, particularly since the last war. And it is very interesting to note, for instance, in the case of the Buddhist teachings, what emphasis was laid upon right behavior in every way, to comport oneself correctly, rightly, gracefully, here is one of the discourses in which a considerable amount of detail is given about the Buddha's ordinary everyday behavior. We know that whenever anybody came to meet him, or he went to meet anybody, which he sometimes did, they always exchanged the greetings and compliments of politeness and courtesy. And the Buddha always inquired, "How are you? Are you all right? Do you have enough food? Are you well?" and so forth. He always made those usual inquiries. And when a holy one makes an inquiry like that, it is not just a verbal ritual. You know how we say, "Oh, hello, how are you?" And and one answers, "Oh, I'm fine, how are you?" And the other person says, "Oh, I'm fine." They're just usually meaningless ritual of words. There's no real substance behind it, often. Sometimes there is, but often there is not. Now, when a holy one asks questions like that, they are very real indeed. They are truly meant. The heart goes out to you as he asks the question, and he listens to you, and so forth. There is that. And then, again, the way one sits, one talks, one walks, all that is carried out in the most perfect way, gracefully, courteously, sensitively, never hurting the other person. The social relationship is as perfect a relationship as one can think of. For instance, it is said, when the revered Gautama, the Buddha, is walking, he leads off with his right foot. And it's rather interesting that in all military discipline you lead off with your left foot, not with your right foot. And it's the same, our custom in India anyway, if we open a door or anything, we use our right hand for it. For all good things, for all auspicious things and circumstances, the right hand is used, the right foot comes first, and so forth. He does not put the foot too far forward. He does not place the foot too short. He does not walk too quickly. He does not walk too slowly. He does not walk knocking knee against knee or ankle against ankle. All these things, they seem funny to us, or rather superfluous as far as stating them is concerned, but it's very interesting to consider the sort of perfect balance, the perfect poise which is involved, which is conveyed in statements like this. While he is walking, he does not bend his thighs up, does not bend his thighs down. How does one bend one's thighs? I don't know. But there you are. It must be descriptive. It must have been descriptive in those days of some peculiar movement of the thighs which makes them say that. As the revered Gautama walks, he moves only with the lower part of his body and does not walk with his full bodily strength. That again I don't quite understand. Only concerned with the action of his legs. I suppose he does not sort of swing around, you know, some people walk like this and some like that, and it's very interesting to see people walking. Very interesting indeed. When he is looking around, he looks round with his whole body. This is what is known as the elephant look. You turn the whole body right round. An elephant can't do that with his head and see you. He turns his whole body round. And I expect that the implication here is to, when you want to look at something which is on the side or behind you, you do it with considerable dignity. Because the elephant is a very dignified creature. He does not look up, he does not look down, and he does not walk without observing, for he looks ahead a plough's length. Further than that, his knowledge and insight becomes unobstructed. Here the text is rather curious, because that last phrase refers to his vision of all things. The commentaries give a detailed explanation of what all that means. On entering into a house, he does not bend his body up nor down, in or out. He turns round not too far from his seat, not too near, and he does not sit down on the seat, clutching hold of it with his hand, nor does he fling his body in a slovenly way onto the seat. Complete gracefulness is implied there. And after all, to be graceful to any object, anything, everything, besides being graceful towards every person, is surely a sign of human courtesy, a recognition of the essential worth of everything and every person. Sign of respect. It's a sign of one's acceptance and acknowledgement of another person's personality. Hence the necessity for gentle speech, for perfect speech, and so forth. In the Zarathustrian scriptures, for instance, it is said that the archangels prayed that Zarathustra would be blessed with sweet speech. Very interesting. When he is seated in a house, he does not fall into unseemly behavior with his hands, does not fall into unseemly behavior with his feet. You know how some people are very restless and they fiddle about, either with their hands or their fingers, their thumbs, or they are always sort of unpoised. Crossing knee over knee or ankle over ankle. I'm afraid I often cross my knee and so forth. Nor does he sit down holding his jaw in his hand. When he is seated in a house, he is not afraid, does not tremble, shake or quiver. And so is the revered Gotama when he is sitting in a house unafraid, untrembling, not shaking, not quivering, unruffled, intent on being completely at ease. And similarly, when he is receiving water to drink or for washing his feet or anything like that, he does not turn the bowl awkwardly, either forward to the person who is pouring the water there, or backward, and so forth, or sideways. He receives neither too little nor too much water. He washes the bowl without making a clatter. He washes the bowl without twirling it round, and until he has put the bowl down on the ground, not until he has put the bowl down on the ground does he wash his hands. By the time the hands are washed, the bowl is washed. By the time the bowl is washed, the hands are washed. He throws away the water from the bowl, not too far, not too near, and without scattering it. The idea of not making a mess. Sometimes one can hear that somebody is doing the washing up. The clatter is very audible. When he is receiving boiled rice, he takes neither too little nor too much. The revered Gotama eats the proper proportion of curry to rice, and the proportion given is one part of curry to three parts of rice. And he does not neglect the rice with each mouthful of curry. Remember that there were no knives and forks in those days. You ate with your hands. That is why the washing of the hands before eating the meal, and so on. The revered Gotama swallows each mouthful only after having turned it round two or three times in his mouth. Now that is a slightly misleading phrase. Actually the practice was to chew every mouthful, every morsel, very, very thoroughly till it was completely liquid, and then swallow it. Which of course is perfectly right from the health point of view. There is not a single grain of boiled rice that enters his body without having been broken up, and not a single grain which remains in his mouth before he proceeds to the next mouthful. Doesn't eat in a hurry. Watch people eat, how they eat. There are very few people who will eat quietly, gently, savoring what they eat. And there's another discourse in which it is said that the Buddha used to savor every mouthful carefully and remain free of attachment and desiring more of it, and free also of aversion, because that would be insulting to your host. He eats food that is possessed of eight characteristics, that is for the health of the body and so forth. There are eight characteristics mentioned. But not for fun or indulgence or personal charm or beautification, but just enough for the support of his body and keeping it going, for keeping it unharmed, for furthering the holy life. Because unless one has a good body, the psyche is likely to be troublesome, and so on. When he has eaten, he sits silent for a moment, but he does not let pass the time for giving thanks. All those centuries back, there was always this giving thanks for what was placed before him and what was eaten. When he has eaten, he gives thanks. He does not decry that meal. He does not hope for another meal. On the contrary, he delights, rouses, inspires, gladdens his hosts with talk on Dhamma, on religion. When he has done that, rising from his seat, he departs. He does not walk too quickly, not too slowly. He does not walk as if anxious to get free of his host. Interesting, all these points of courtesy and understanding, and gentleness towards everything and everyone. Just one other thing. As regards his talk, he gladdens any assembly with talk on religion. The sound that issues from the revered Gotama's mouth is possessed of these characteristics. It is distinct, intelligible, sweet, audible, and fluent, and clear, and deep, and resonant. He must have been a sort of a very fine baritone, I expect. That was his voice. And he always gladdened the people to whom he spoke. Now, those are just a few simple expressions of the care that was taken with regard to ordinary everyday behavior. So I think it is rather useful to think about some of those points when we are by ourselves and observe our own behavior in all these matters. Walking, sitting, standing, talking, eating, because these are things we do every day. And they all conduce, if they are done mindfully, towards self-knowledge. If I eat very restlessly, for instance, and quickly, swallowing my food, why am I doing it? If I am mindful, I shall come to know something about myself, whether I am moved by anxiety or fear, or whether I want to get rid of the food as quickly as possible because it's distasteful or whatever it may be, and so forth. So there are ways and means in our ordinary everyday behavior for understanding the state of our psyche. And if we understand it, then through the understanding, the purification proceeds. Not by saying this ought not to be the case and that ought to be the case. These oughts are merely sources of conflict. But just to observe, and if the observation reaches its maturity, its fullness, then the change in the psyche takes place in consequence. seeing the fact is what transforms the fact.